Accession number 4799, rule number 1.
Reel 1. Air Marshal, as you know, the Imperial War Museum is collecting and recording experiences and recollections of the Royal Air Force during the interwar years. And of course, your career went far beyond that to service during the war and then to senior rank after the war. And then you retired at your own request to take up an important position in industry. So I think it's worth recording, just by way of introduction, that what we're going to talk about from the period of 1918 to 1939, the very interesting formative years for the service, in the event, of course, was only a fragment of your distinguished career. But if we can confine ourselves to that, and perhaps now we could talk about how you came into the service in the early days of learning to fly.
Yes. I carry on?
Yep.
I had always been interested in flying ever since I was a schoolboy, and therefore I determined to join the Royal Flying Corps as soon as it was possible for me to do so. I tried to join before I was 18, but that was impossible because they demanded to see one's birth certificate. I therefore joined the Royal Flying Corps on my 18th birthday, which was the 10th of October, 1917. After a lot of drill and ground instruction at Denham, at Denham and Hastings, I was posted to Beaulieu in the New Forest to learn to fly. I started learning to fly in April 1918, and my instructor was a certain Captain Broadbury. The standard of instruction in those days varied enormously from one instructor to another, but on the whole, it was not particularly good. I went solo after 4.5 hours dual instruction.
What aircraft was that?
The aircraft we were learning on was an Avro called the Mono Avro, because the engine was a Mono Soupape gnome. As I say, I went solo after four and a half hours. I had no difficulty in flying the aeroplane, but I did find difficulty in landing. And my instructor, Captain Broadbury, said I was the best pupil he'd ever had as regards flying an aeroplane, but I was the worst he'd ever had in landing. I was therefore given to another instructor for a short time, whose name was Simpson, and he explained to me, which had not been explained to me before, was that you had to stall the aeroplane to land it. And as soon as I realized this, I had no further difficulty and was able to land quite normally and successfully. After a certain amount of time solo on the Avro, and then next graduated onto the Sopwith Pup, which was a single-seater aircraft with a Lerone gnome or Lerone engine. And after that, one graduated onto the Sopwith Camel. I should just say that on my second flight on a Sopwith Pup, the engine cut out completely when I was comparatively low down, and I committed the unforgivable sin of turning back. I stalled the airplane and crashed from several hundred feet. The airplane was a complete write-off, and I was extremely lucky to get away with it. I cut my face rather badly and had it sewn up by an old doctor who I think was slightly alcoholic, because he had the most terrible shakes. But anyway, he managed to sew up my face, and I was given a fortnight's leave and started flying again as soon as I got back. I then graduated. There was no dual camel in those days. I then graduated onto the Sopwith Camel, which was a world famous fighter. It was powered by a 130 horsepower Piaget engine, or it could also be powered by a 110 Lerone horsepower engine.
Was that a Le Clerget?
Le
Clerget.
Yeah. The Royal Naval Air Service had some Sopwith Camels powered by a Bentley rotary engine of 150 horsepower, but these were not given to the RFC or the RAF. After a bit of time on camels at Bewley, I was not yet 19, and a rule had been brought in because of the very high casualties that had occurred in France, that people were not to be posted to a squadron in France until they were 19. I was therefore sent to the School of Special Flying at Gosport to be taught to be an instructor. This school was founded by Major Smith Barry, and it became in due course the world-famous Central Flying School. My instructor at Gosport was a certain Captain Corriton, who retired many years later as Air Marshal Sir Alec Corriton. And as far as I am aware, he is still alive and kicking. The course lasted about 3 to 4 weeks, and I successfully completed it and was posted back to Bewley to instruct other pupils. This I did for the rest of my time there on Avros, and occasionally, as often as possible, got flew Sopwith Camels to keep my hand in on the single-seater fighter, or scout, as it was called in those days. I was duly posted overseas when I became 19 and joined a 65 squadron, which was then stationed at Bissingham, just outside Courtrai. I arrived there very, very late in October, and didn't actually join the squadron until the 9th of November, which was 2 days before the armistice. I therefore, unfortunately, much to my bitter disappointment, had no active experience of fighting in the First War. I remained with 65 Squadron, the commanding officer of which was Major de Crepney, whom I think I am right in saying was the youngest CO of a squadron in those days. I'm not absolutely sure, but I think he was 21. I stayed with the squadron until 1919, and we did flights all over France to as demonstrations to the French and the Belgians. One rather interesting thing I was fortunate enough to experience was that we were sent a German fighter, the Fokker D7, to the squadron, and I was able to fly this airplane on two occasions. It was powered by a 200 horsepower stationary BMW engine. And so you can see that the BMW car today that you see on the road so often had a very long, long history, because it was the same company that was building the BMW aero engine in those days, and a very good engine it was.
Did that Fokker D7 have a good record?
Yes, it was one of the best German fighters produced, and was held in great respect by everybody concerned. It was quite straightforward, as far as I remember, it was quite straightforward to fly. The one thing I do remember about it, which was unusual, was that the throttle for the engine was on the joystick. This took a little bit of getting used to, and of course all the instruments were in metric, and that took a little bit of getting used to as well, but it was a very nice aeroplane to fly. The squadron was due to re-equip with, had the war gone on, with Sopwith Snipes, which had a 200 horsepower Bentley rotary engine, and we did get one of these aircraft, and so I was able to get some experience on the Sopwith Snipe, which remained in service in the Royal Air Force until the 1920s. It was on a Sopwith Snipe that I can't remember now whether it is. I think it was Billy. It was either Billy Bishop or. Oh, I cannot remember the name of who got his Victoria Cross when flying a Snipe. I was then posted home from the squadron to do a course at Andover in the School of Navigation and Bomb Dropping. The aircraft concerned was the Handy Page twin-engined bomber, and we were passengers in this aircraft, in these aircraft, and we did navigation, cross-country navigation, both by day and by night. I cannot say that I found this, after flying single-seater fighters, a very exhilarating experience. In fact, I was bored to tears. However, they had at Andover at that time a couple of Snipe and two Bristol monoplanes, both of which I flew. The Bristol monoplane never entered service except in very small numbers, as far as I am aware, in what was then called Mesopotamia, right towards the end of the war. It had a 110 horsepower Lerone engine, but only one machine gun, whereas of course all the other fighters, like the SE-5, which incidentally I flew an SE-5 in when I was in 65 Squadron, and they all had twin machine guns, two Vickers guns, firing through the propeller in the case of the Camel, and in the case of the SE-5 there was one gun firing through the propeller, and the other gun, Lewis gun, was mounted on the top wing and could be pulled down so that the pilot could put a new drum of ammunition on it. So I was able to get the Bristol monoplane. I heard, I don't know if this is true or not, when it was first produced, it was flown by a test pilot who said that it was much too difficult. It landed much too fast and was very difficult to land, and therefore he didn't recommend that it should be adopted by the service. All I can say is that that pilot was extremely stupid, because it was perfectly straightforward to land, it was a lovely aeroplane to fly, extremely maneuverable, and it was a pity that it never entered service in any quantities.
That Handley Page bomber, of course, was the first movement towards heavy bombing.
That is perfectly true. Yes, it was. And I think I'm right in saying, in fact, I'm almost certain I'm right in saying that it was used as a bomber towards the end of the first war. It had two. Two Rolls-Royce engines. At the end of the course at Andover, which was in August, I was posted to Old Sarum, just before I was demobilized. At Old Sarum, the only thing of any interest is that they had there, and I did fly a BE-2E, which was a very, very slightly modified BE-2C, which of course was used extensively during the war. It had a 90 horsepower RAF engine, which stood for Royal Aircraft Factory. It was known by the nickname of the Quirk. Why? I haven't the faintest idea. But it was quite straightforward to fly, and it was interesting to have flown this very well-known but rather dreary aircraft. In September of 1919, I was finally demobilized, much to my disappointment.
If I may interrupt you there, Air Marshal Mem. Of course, this period covered the formation of the Royal Air Force from the RFC and the RNS.
Yes.
Was there any sort of great awareness of this at, you know, the junior officer level? Was it a smooth operation or a contentious one?
Practically no awareness of it at all. In fact, I think it is correct to say that anybody of a youngster like myself, we were just told that we were no longer the RFC, we were the RAF, and we said, well, what does that stand for? And they said, oh, the Royal Air Force. We wore exactly the same uniform, the maternity jacket, and the fore and aft cap, until the new uniform was designed, and it was, of course, not blue, it was khaki. And so we had to wear that instead of the maternity jacket. But from the point of view of any effect it had on us in those days, the effect was nil. Well, as I say, I was demobilized in 1919. I had applied to go to Russia, where several squadrons were sent, as I thought I might get some active service flying there, but there were so many applicants that I was unlucky and was demobilized instead. I spent 2 years out of the service, during which time I was apprenticed to a firm called Thornycroft in Basingstoke as what was called a premium pupil. My father paid some money, and I was gradually taught to be an engineer. Life in a factory in those days was fairly tough going. You were not allowed to smoke. There was no heating of any sort whatever. All the machine tools were driven by belts from an overhead shaft. And if you were more than 10 minutes late in the morning, you were locked out for the rest of the day and got no pay of any sort. So I cannot help smiling to myself when I see some of the people coming out on strike today for conditions that are about 500 times better than they were in those days. I think you may be interested to know how it came about that I returned to the service. A friend of mine and myself were having a glass of beer in a pub in Abingdon, and we heard two young men talking, saying that they were going to rejoin the Air Force. So we asked them to tell us about it, and they told us about Lord Trenchard's short service commission scheme commission for 4 years. My friend and myself therefore decided that that was just what we should do. So I went to my father and told him that that's what I was going to do. He thought I was quite mad, but said, well, if that is what you feel you ought to do, you better do it. We therefore applied and were accepted after a most extremely stringent medical examination, and we were posted to Uxbridge as flying officers. The rank of pilot officer, excuse me, the rank of pilot officer had not yet then quite been introduced. So we were the most junior flying officers in the whole of the service. We spent some weeks at Uxbridge, where we were drilled on the square by a squadron leader called Womble, who was always known as Pussy Womble. I cannot think why, because he was a large man, he had a voice like a foghorn, and he gave us absolute hell on the parade ground. After 2 or 3 weeks there, oh, incidentally, at that time I decided to get married. And I went to my commanding officer and I said, may I have your permission to get married, sir? He looked me straight in the face and he said, unfortunately, I cannot prevent you. My wife and I were married then in 1921. I was then given a refresher course in flying on Avros, Bristol Fighters, and de Havilland 9As at Northolt and Kenley. And in March 1922, I was posted to Iraq. It may be of interest to note that in those days no wives were allowed to accompany their husbands to Iraq, and so after we'd been married for only 3 months, I was sent to Iraq for 3 years where no women were allowed. I went out to Iraq by trooper in a ship called the SS Assay, which was an old P&O liner. We ran into the worst storm. It was an army trooper and by the Oxford and Bucks light infantry. We ran into the worst storm in the channel that had been recorded for many years. The barometric reading was in 28 point something inches, the lowest recorded barometric reading in this country for a very long time. The storm was appalling, and practically everybody except about half a dozen of us was sick. The conditions for the troops below deck in their hammocks was quite appalling, and the CO of the Oxford and Bucks Light Infantry did not show his face on deck because he was so ill until we reached port side. However, all is well that ends well, and at port side we transshipped to another ship which took us to Mesopotamia, as it was then called, in the shape of going to up the Persian Gulf to via Karachi, where we spent a bit of time, and we arrived in Iraq, in Mesopotamia, in the end of March or beginning of April. I was posted to number 55 squadron, which was stationed at Mosul. It may be of interest if I just say what the Royal Air Force consisted of in Iraq in those days. There were 8 squadrons, 55 squadron at Mosul, which I will remark on shortly, 55 squadron at Mosul, 84 squadron at Shaiba, and 45 squadron, 70 squadron, 6 squadron, and 8 squadron, and number 1 squadron on Sopwith Snipes were at Hanaidi, just outside Baghdad. It may be of further interest to note that the squadron leader commanding 45 squadron happened to be to have the name of A.T. Harris. Squadron leader A.T. Harris, who was the A.T. Harris who was to become world famous as Bert Harris, the commander-in-chief of Bomber Command for practically the whole of the Second War. I will now go on to my experiences in 55 Squadron in Mosul. The squadron was commanded by a certain squadron leader, Gaskell Blackburn, who was the only RAF officer with a beard. He was not, beloved by everybody, because he never flew and was not, in our opinion, a particularly good squadron commander. We had, however, some magnificent flight commanders, one of whom had the name of Cunningham. And he became Mary Cunningham. He was always known as Mary because he was a New Zealander, and Mary was a corruption of Mary. Mary Cunningham was one of the flight commanders. Another flight commander was Hugh Wormsley, who was to end up as Sir Hugh Wormsley and an Air Marshal much later on. We also had as a flight commander a man by the name of Bill Hazel. He had made a great name for himself in the First War for having shot down more enemy balloons than anybody else. You couldn't wish for a finer man, and he did eventually, for a comparatively short time, command the squadron until he was contracted typhoid and was very ill, and had to leave the squadron for some considerable time. The work of the squadron in those days was mainly concerned with dealing with the Kurdish problem in the mountainous north of the country. The Kurds were rather like the tribes in the northwest frontier in India, in that they wanted their own organization in their own country, and we had to deal with them when they were trying to cause trouble amongst all the local tribes. They were aided and abetted by Turkey,